supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Depression. Most of us have experienced it or know someone who has. I know I have. I've had several episodes of clinical depression, and we all know it can be debilitating. It's much more than just a sad mood. But what we know about it has been changing, especially as we learn more about the brain. But today, we're going to take a fresh look at depression. Joining me in the first part of the show by phone are clinical psychologists Drs. Michael Yapko, who's written a number of books, including Depression is Contagious and Treating Depression with Hypnosis. And we're also joined by psychologist Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg. He's the associate professor at the University of South Florida, and he's written The Depths and the Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. So, Jonathan, first to both of you, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan, let's start with you. For well over a century, it's been considered a psychological disorder. And now as we learn more about the brain, it's considered a chemical imbalance. So what do you say?
Well, depression certainly involves changes in the brain. So does happiness. So does every psychological state. But I dispute the notion that depression is a disease, like diabetes is a disease or Huntington's disease is a disease. There is no blood test or other biologically based diagnostic test for depression. And I think nor will there be, despite the tremendous efforts to understand the biological basis for depression. So I think that's fundamentally a misguided approach.
How can you be so confident that you don't think there will be a test for depression?
Well, depression fundamentally is about a person's interaction with their environment. And our mechanisms for generating depression overlap with normal mechanisms for generating mood. So people get depressed for a whole host of reasons. I think that fundamentally it's the wrong model. Huntington's disease is a direct result of a defective gene. There's a single gene that's responsible for that. People have been looking for many decades, and at best, there were a number of genes that are weakly associated with depression, and I think it's just fundamentally the wrong model. And so we can look as hard as we like, but if we're animated by the wrong question, we won't find an answer.
That's interesting. Spoken like a true researcher, Michael. I want to understand the epidemiology of depression. The World Health Organization recently predicted that very soon depression would become the second greatest cause of human suffering and disability. That's incredible. So, I mean, the subtext of that is that it is spreading around the world. But why? Why is it increasing?
Well, there are lots of reasons. The world has changed, and borders no longer keep people separated from each other. People are traveling all over the place. We have a shared outlook. We have a common technological framework. The institutions that used to hold societies together no longer hold societies together. Families have changed. Governments have changed. Political institutions have changed. And the kinds of stressors that people face as they increase and they have less of the foundations that they used to have to hold them together, religion, politics, education, people are more vulnerable. People are more easily overwhelmed. Depression.
Why is that? that people are more easily overwhelmed?
You know, when we've had a full generation of the feel-good philosophy, that you're supposed to feel good all the time, that you're supposed to minimize any kinds of difficulties or challenges, the so-called helicopter parents who make sure that their kids never face any kind of an adversity, people aren't learning the kinds of coping skills, they're not learning the kinds of problem-solving skills, they're not learning the kinds of social skills. I think if you get 100 therapists into a room and ask them, so are any of you deeply impressed with how skilled the under 25s are these days, I don't think any of them would say yes.
So let me interrupt you right there for a moment, because I'm curious. I mean, you've explained, Michael, why it's spreading around the world, but I wonder where it's growing. Where are the highest rates of depression? Do we know that?
Yes, it's growing in every age group and every demographic group. But the fastest growing group of depression sufferers are the young people, the under 25s.
What about what countries? Do we know what countries are more depressed than others?
Yes, we do. There are cross-national epidemiological studies that are conducted all the time. Surprisingly, I think for many people, France is right at the top of the list right now. The United States is not too far behind other countries where depression is much, much lower, and other cultures where it's much lower.
Where?
And it just reinforces what Jonathan was saying, that the disease model, the biological model, is really an obsolete way of thinking about the nature of depression. That when we see these differences from culture to culture, country to country, it places a huge emphasis on social learning being the problem rather than biology.
So what countries have the lowest rates of depression?
Trying to remember the list that I saw most recently.
Let me share an experience that I had with you. A couple of years ago, I was in South Africa, and I went to visit a school for children with all sorts of disabilities, medical, physical, psychological, and it was complete poverty they were living in. And everybody there seemed joyful. And the woman who founded the school looked to be about 80 years old. And she's coming out of her hut that she'd been living in for 30 years, and she just got electricity a couple of months earlier. And she comes out on a cane, obviously arthritic and in pain, and she's got this big smile on her face. And I said to her, "You look happy." And she said, "Oh, I am." And I said, "What makes you happy?" And she beamed at me, and she said, "As long as my hut is happy, I'm happy. As long as my hut is clean, I'm happy." And then a week later, I was vacationing at the shore, and people were complaining that their pizza didn't arrive on time. They weren't happy. So
what you're describing is when people have a much more self-oriented perspective, which is a big part of what we teach in the West, as opposed to a much more other-oriented. When you look at the cultures that do have a lower rate of depression, they're invariably much more connected to each other, not isolated. It's one of the things about how our society has evolved, that people are more alone than they have ever been, and many are more lonely than they have ever been.
I read an article years ago that suggested that sustained loneliness can be as lethal as tobacco, as smoking.
Correct.
That's amazing. And so what you seem to be pointing out is that our brains are social organs, and if that's not kept healthy, then we deteriorate somehow.
Well, you know, common sense tells that to people. Just think of how often other people are the source of our depression. other people who hurt us, betray us, humiliate us, reject us, devalue us, hurt us physically, right, as well as emotionally. And when relationships go badly and people don't have the ability to connect or the ability to maintain connections, it shows. It shows in the quality of their life, the quality of their decision making, the way that they feel about themselves, the way they feel about the world.
I want to follow up here with Jonathan, and Jonathan, I want to get your take on this. You know, depression has increased so much, and the adult suicide rate has gone up 25% in the last 15 years, and I know the adolescent suicide rate is increased even more. And it's interesting. You know, things are pretty good in this country. They're better than they've been in a long time.
Well, depression isn't about the material world. I think your anecdote about the woman in South Africa is very telling. And part of the problem is that people are believing and wanting, now it sounds like a very American goal, to want to feel happy. But in the United States and other Western countries, this goal has kind of crowded out other goals. And in fact, if you want to feel happy, probably the best thing that you could do would be to think about other goals, because happiness is something that sort of comes to you while you're making other plans, to quote John Lennon. But when people become fixated on this goal of feeling happy, they actually tend to feel worse, because achieving happiness isn't like achieving other goals, like learning to play the piano or, you know, learn new computer software, where if you just work at it harder, you will make progress towards that goal. Setting a goal to become happier is more like putting yourself on a treadmill that goes faster the harder you run.
Yeah, and when
people have this, sorry, go ahead.
And when you get that happiness, it's like eating a candy bar when you're starving. You know, it tastes good, but there's no real nutrients in it, and it goes away pretty quickly.
Sure. I mean, I think that it's ironic that there is so much depression and low mood in a culture where, more than I think at any time that I can think in human history, that people are asking themselves the question, am I happy? Am I happy enough? And one reason I think that this question is being answered in the negative is that there's a lot of referencing of other people on social media, and the perception that other people, if you look on Facebook and on other social media, are there leading a glorious kind of euphoric existence with perfect children and perfect vacations. And the difficulty of realizing that those images are actually illusory.
Yeah,
they may be putting a false front forward.
Yeah, maybe. How many do, especially on social media? I could argue that we even do it in personal interactions. You know, we put on our best face. Let me reintroduce you for those who are just tuning in. We're taking a new look at depression, and one that's very, very different from the traditional one. I'm talking with Drs. John Rottenberg and Michael Yapko. Our phone numbers are 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'd really like to hear from you if you've had experience with depression, and what helped and what didn't help in your treatment. I want to switch gears a minute, and I want to talk about this contagion of depression that Michael and you referred to in your book. Certainly, you know, it's contagious genetically, and when we're raised by a depressed parent, we're more at risk for depression and or, you know, being a caretaker in our future relationships. But what's contagious beyond that?
Well, you know, the way that you just said it makes it sound like this is a genetic problem, and the genetic heritability is there, but it's a relatively mild one, as I think Jonathan pointed out earlier. What we have are not genes that make us depression. We have genes that make us vulnerable to depression, depending on external circumstances. This is what the field of epigenetics is exploring. How does environment change genetic expression? But when we look at the point that the child of a depressed parent is anywhere from 3 to 6 times more likely to become depressed than the child of a non-depressed parent, the answer is to be found in the interactional patterns. Every time that your 2-year-old or 3-year-old asks, "Mommy, why? Daddy, why?" your answer inevitably contains what are called attributions, explanations that help this child start to develop cause-effect understandings and styles of thinking. And it's through modeling. It's through the way that you demonstrate how to cope, whether to cope. You can't teach kids what you don't know. And so that's really where the vulnerability is in the interactions between parents and children.
And you know, if you're being raised by a depressed parent, you're going to be raised by a parent who behaves depressed.
Exactly. That's what I mean when I say you can't teach a kid what you don't know. If your response to stress is to go get drunk, you're not teaching your child the best of coping skills. If your response to a problem is to ignore it, you're not teaching your child the best of problem-solving skills.
You're not kidding. Let's see if we can get a phone call in before our break. We've got Orlando on the line.
Hello.
Hello.
Dr. Gottlieb.
What can we do for you?
Well, it's a great honor to be speaking with you all today. I am totally blind from birth. I'm 42 years old, a lifelong professional musician. I'm in a PhD program at UPenn. I've pretty much outed myself at this point. And, you know, over the past year, I have been through many adversities, circumstantial adversities that have, against my better efforts, caused a pretty debilitating depression. And part of the problem, at least with blind people, is that there are so many components that need to be in place to achieve and to rely upon the most basic things in life that sighted people take for granted. Physical activity, healthy nutrition, medical care, employment.
Is this depression, Orlando, the first you've experienced?
It's actually the second. The only time I experienced anything I would identify as depression was when I got divorced 10 years ago. And so this time I'm on Medicaid, and I went to a local clinic and was given 75 milligrams of Effexor, which I took for a week of constant nausea, headaches.
What else did they prescribe besides medication?
Well, I have been seeing a therapist there also at the clinic, who has been very helpful.
All right, let me put you on hold there for a minute. And I want to take our experts here and see what they have to say. So, Michael, you do a lot of clinical work with people who are depressed. So he's got the standard treatment. Orlando is getting the standard treatment, and that was medication and psychotherapy. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, the fact that he has found the therapy helpful is wonderful. The fact fact that he was prescribed an antidepressant is pretty much to be expected, that it, because it is the predominant form of treatment, unfortunately. And so it's hard to know whether the medication has been providing any therapeutic benefit. Perhaps it has. He says that the counseling has been helpful to him. I think it's important to be very, very specific about what the expectations for counseling are, how the therapy is supposed to be structured, what kinds of specific skills are targeted as part of the treatment regimen. And so, you know, the fact that he's receiving some benefit, I'm happy for him. That's great.
And Jonathan, what's your take?
Well, it strikes me in Orlando's comments that his predicament is, you know, despite, you know, him having some unique circumstances with blindness, the predicament of many people who seek help for depression, that they're really overwhelmed by their mood. They don't understand their mood. And though it sounds like he's gotten some benefit from the counseling, it seems to me that fundamentally many people who certainly take medications and have psychotherapy don't get tremendous insight into the sources of their mood, things that they can actually change, whether it's their physical routines that may be hurting their mood or their goals, which may be impacting their mood.
Well,
so I think that's critical.
Well, I want to come back. We got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about that whole business of mood, Jonathan, and mood science, which is fairly new. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg, who's written The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. We're also talking with Dr. Michael Yapko, who's written many books about depression, including Depression is Contagious, Breaking the Patterns of Depression, and Treating Depression with Hypnosis. And we're going to talk about that a bit after the break also. Later on, we're going to hear from Dr. John O'Riordan, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Rowan, and he's a leader in the use of transmagnetic stimulation. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Wilma Theater supports WHYY and presents Dan O'Brien's The Body of an American. In 2007, Dan O'Brien heard an interview on Fresh Air between Terry Gross and the photojournalist Paul Watson, who shared the story behind his Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph of a dead American soldier being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. Dan reached out to Paul, and the two formed a profound relationship. A contemporary war story encompassing personal and global histories, The Body of an American runs through February 1st. Details at 215-546-7824 or wilmatheater.org.
On the next Fresh Air, David Adam. His new book, The Man Who Couldn't Stop, is part memoir, part science about his struggle with OCD. He tells himself,
I know this is ridiculous. I am a educated, reasonably scientifically literate person, and yet I have this irrational fear.
He'll tell us about his own compulsion and how he learned to keep it from controlling his life. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We're taking a new look at depression, what it is, and some new treatments also. Jonathan Rottenberg, I want to know more about mood science. Can we objectively measure moods?
Sure.
Sure, he says.
Yes, we can. which is to say, moods are complicated, right? They involve our feelings, but they also harness our behavior. So if you want to measure a mood, you would probably do more than just ask the person. You can look at the physiology of mood. That's useful. You can measure people's behavior. That also gives you a window onto mood. So absolutely, and those are some of the changes that have happened in the last 30 years that have allowed us to begin to measure mood and emotion in more objective ways.
Well, you know, we're talking about moods here and depression contagion. So I know, And I guess I'll turn to you, Michael. You know, when we are with a depressed person, we feel depressed in that moment. But you're not saying that we can get a clinical depression from hanging out with somebody who's depressed, or are you?
Well, I think if you look in the broadest sense and you look at the quality of relationships between people, this is what the studies show, is that depression does increase in social networks. Now, if we ask the question, what is the mechanism for that, there are many different mechanisms that can be operating. For some people, it's just their own bad boundaries, that they feel what other people feel. They don't really have the ability to differentiate themselves very well from somebody else's feeling. For other people, they are influenced by this person's perspective, and they adopt a similar perspective, the same as they might on other kinds of issues. Likewise, similar ways of coping, similar ways of responding to external stresses that create the parallels that become the contagion. So that when we talk about the contagion of depression, it's not that it's a viral thing or a bacterial thing, it's a social thing. In the same way that everybody can relate to the fact that there are some people who walk into a room and they instantly spread rainbows and sunshine, and inside of 5 minutes everybody's holding hands and singing Kumbaya. And then there's other people that walk into a room and instantly suck the energy right out of it and turn it into a black hole. So the fact that moods are contagious and outlooks are contagious is not anything particularly new, but to see the extent in social networks of how much it influences mood states like depression is really remarkable.
I have to tell you, I'm living the wrong kind of life, because I've never met anybody. I've met happy people, but I've never met anybody that made me want to sing Kumbaya since the 80s, and that wasn't about people. That was about a whole different phenomenon back then. So, such a person, would you mind texting me their name? I'm going to see them for therapy.
Many people that know how to move through the world making other people feel good.
Yeah, I know that. I'm just kidding. Speaking of therapy, let's go to the phones. Okay, we'll take another caller. We've got Thomas on the line from Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi. What can we do
Hi.
For you?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say that I was depressed between the ages of 22 to 30. I'm now 59. It was pretty bad. I had OCD and something else. But what I found during my therapy was, before I found a therapist, I hardly had any money, so I went through a lot of different therapists on a very low budget. And eventually I found one who, well, what she did was not break eye contact, and she listened. And I was also had institutionalized myself were about a month and a half. So I went through all this because I knew I had a problem with my thinking and when she did not break eye contact and she really listened to what I had to say, that made a big difference for me.
Well,
and the patient does watch, you know, does make observations. That's what I found within myself. They observe you as much as you observe now.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, Thomas, what you're talking about really underscores what Jonathan and Michael are saying, that it really is about relationships, and relationships help us heal. I'm curious about your take, Jonathan. Am I oversimplifying?
Well, obviously, it wasn't only just the hour spent with the therapist, though it is wonderful to, you know, get that kind of regard, to feel like when you're isolated and feeling down and feeling unimportant, that there's one person who you are very important to them, and they listen to what you say and they understand what you say. But I think the critical thing is learning things in a session that then you can learn, you can try out outside of the session. And I suspect your caller, in addition to getting this kind of gratification of making this important human connection, as you're alluding to, also learned some things that were applicable in his everyday life.
I have to tell you, when I had my depression, it was about 5 years after my accident. I'm a quadriplegic. So I guess after, you know, I was on the steep learning curve of learning how to be a quad, that's when the depression hit. And my predominant emotion there was shame about this. I thought I was crazy. I was afraid to open my mouth. I was afraid for anyone to know what I was thinking, what was going on in my mind. It was terrible, terrible shame. And once I realized it was depression and I opened that up to my colleagues and friends, most of whom were shrinks like me, things started to change. So, I mean, shame really poisons the well. Michael?
It does. And you know, the fact that you have an idea, each of us has an idea about what other people are going to approve of, what people are going to find acceptable, you know, highlights the power of the relationship and the power of expectations within the relationship. Again, when I talk about how often other people are the source of our problems, the flip side is how often other people are the solution. How often they can provide a framework and a way of feeling about ourselves as we see ourselves through other people's eyes, the people who can find in us things that we don't find in ourselves, the strengths, the resources, the things that are right with us instead of just the things that are wrong with us. And I think when you look at the studies on the merits of psychotherapy, the value of psychotherapy, there's no question that therapy is valuable. And when we ask the questions of what is it about therapy that's valuable, there are many different factors that predict therapeutic outcome, predict therapeutic success. But what comes up time and time again as the number one factor is the quality of that therapeutic relationship. And I think that's what your caller is really emphasizing.
Jonathan, tell us about your history of depression and what the experience was like, and more important, what kind of treatment did you have?
Okay, so I was studying history in Baltimore a little more than 20 years ago, and I came to understand that what I was experiencing was depression, but it took a very long time. Experienced a whole bunch of debilitating symptoms. I was one of these men who thought that they were invulnerable to depression, and so it took me a while to recognize and to get into treatment. I was treated with pretty standard psychiatry, which is to say medications. I went on medications singly and in combination. I was also an inpatient, and it was a very profound thing because I went from really not understanding at all what this experience was, other than that it was horrible and that I thought that it was going to take my life, to having a kind of hope. And it really wasn't the treatment so much as my own realization that I had just experienced something very profound, horrible, but very profound, and that I needed to really change my life. And so I changed my career. I went back to school to study psychology to try to understand how moods get formed and how moods can really overpower a person. And so in understanding myself and what had happened to me, I believe that I've learned some things that, you know, could be beneficial to other people as well.
You know, what I hear in that, and we've only got a few minutes left, what I hear in that is what we call, well, first metacognition, is to be able to take a step back and look at yourself, you know, from almost an objective viewpoint, you know, and look at your brain and your mind and realize that there's something going on that you know, indicate something in your life. And the other thing I'm hearing, though, is courage. You know, it takes courage to, you know, how many people do we all know that say, I need to change my life? And almost none of them do it. It takes courage to do that, especially when you're feeling in a depressed state.
Well, I agree. And depression does come with it a huge loss of morale. And one of the major symptoms of depression is this belief that the future can't change. And yet we have not just myself, but millions of people who have recovered from their depression and taken their lives in new directions. And in fact, it's a little told story, but an important one, that they have emerged in many ways actually stronger and in some ways even better for having had the depression in the first place. And I really think that does need some emphasis, because it's not just a hopeful thing, but it's a truthful thing.
Well, you know, we talk a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder, but what you're indicating is post-traumatic growth. Listen, gentlemen, there's so much we didn't get to talk about. I wanted to talk more about hypnosis. Jonathan, there's so much more I want our listeners to hear about your Out of the Dark campaign, and we're going to have that on our webpage. And I highly, highly, to our listeners, recommend these books. These are some of the best books on the subject that I've ever read. Michael, Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Michael Yapko is a clinical psychologist, and he's written Depression is Contagious, Breaking the Patterns of Depression. Jonathan Rottenberg has written The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Right after this short break, we're going to be talking with Dr. John O'Riordan, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Rowan University. And he's really a leader, a prime mover in the use of transmagnetic stimulation. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Morning, I'm Jennifer Lynn, WHYY News. 2015 isn't looking like a... It's a chilly 18 degrees. Oh, Coming up this morning, WHYY's Kevin Mc...
No.
Is it actually harder to get out of bed this time of year?
10 more minutes.
Or does it just seem this
way? Andy, WHYY's finger off the snooze button. You need to listen up.
Sorry, Jenny. Jenny's.
WHYY, every day, everywhere.
I'm Robin Young. A new book looks at the most effective ways to treat trauma.
Trauma is an experience that overwhelms your capacity to cope. People feel helpless, overwhelmed, scared to death. At the core of trauma is horror.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking now with Dr. John O'Riordan. He's the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Rowan University. He's a leader in the use of transmagnetic stimulation. And I've known Johnny for years, and I consider him a dear friend. John O'Riordan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
So, you heard most of the first part of the show?
Yes, I did.
All right. So, tell me your thoughts.
Well, I agree that it's very important, the social factors in depression, and nobody would dispute that for a minute. But we must not also, at the same time, ignore the brain. The brain is important. Biology is important. And you can have two individuals in the same situation exposed to the same circumstances, and one develops depression and the other does not. So individual genetic susceptibility is also important. But the importance of therapy, amongst many other things, is addressing precipitating factors that comes within the individual circumstances. And none of us who are psychiatrists would deny that for a moment.
I wonder, you're one of the prime movers of transmagnetic stimulation. Tell us what it is.
Well, transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS for short, involves taking a magnetic field and applying it to the scalp, and that pulsing magnetic field reaches the surface of the brain, what we call the prefrontal cortex, and it activates parts of the prefrontal cortex that are shut off or shut down in depression. So we can see consequences of depression in the brain in the way it affects certain centers in the brain. And the TMS re-energizes nerve cells or neurons in the brain that have got shut down, or if you like, are on strike and are not responding in the way they ordinarily would. And the treatment takes about 4 to 6 weeks. It is a very, very safe treatment in that it has virtually no side effects other than some minor scalp discomfort. And the patient is awake and in control of everything that's happening during the session, and that they're awake and alert, and then they can leave the session immediately and go home without needing transportation by anybody.
Well, before we get into any more details about that, and I do, I want to take a call. We've got Sam on the phone. Sam?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I guess my comment doesn't quite and question doesn't quite go along with what our guest is currently talking about, but...
You there? Sam? Oh, we lost Sam. No. Sam, are you there? Okay, let's try John.
Yeah.
Ah, we have you. So, go into more detail for us about how these actually work and with whom do they work?
Well, in TMS, as the name implies, it's magnetic energy that's activating the neurons in the brain. There are other new technologies. One, for instance, is called TDCS, or transcranial direct current stimulation, which uses electrical energy to activate neurons, or more specifically, to change their excitability.
Uses what kind of energy?
Electrical energy. It's a tiny, tiny current that flows on the surface of the scalp, about 1/1000th of an amp, and that has the effect of shifting the excitability of the neurons in that it makes them more receptive to normal functioning. And that technology is a very promising one and also has the advantage that it's not expensive. It's about 5 times less expensive than TMS in terms of the cost of the devices. And this is under active research around the world right now, and I would say in a couple of 2 to 3 years, it'll be at the point of possible FDA approval.
Wow. Well, you were really instrumental in getting FDA approval. What population did you work with?
We work with patients that had not responded to existing treatment. So they may have had therapy, they may have had some antidepressants already. So they are what we call the treatment-resistant population, and that's about 4 million people in the U.S. So these patients were very severely ill. They could work on their relationships all you want, but they still continued to be depressed. And they went into the study where they either had the true TMS or a disguised sham form of the TMS. We were able to show to the FDA satisfaction that the treatment really worked and should be made available to patients. And that was in 2008, and now there are many TMS centers around the country where you can get that treatment. And the private insurers have been very slow in paying for it, but fortunately Medicare does, so that's a big bonus.
That's great. All right, we've got Sam back on the phone. Let's have a chat with Sam. Sorry about that, Sam.
Oh, no problem.
So go on.
Okay. So yeah, I think I've been, I guess, dealing with depression for almost half my life. My father had depression and ended up actually committing suicide when I was 12. And then beyond that, my grandfather actually committed suicide, but he was actually on my mother's side. So it was a kind of a split, not a direct line of in my heritage, but it's it's been a troublesome aspect of my life for as long as I can remember now. So it's definitely a consideration being suicide. And I guess at this point in my life, I don't think it's as much of a conflict. But, I mean, I've been through the standard therapies and counseling and whatnot, and it's actually kind of like what you're talking about now, because it's something that I seem to not be able to shake actively and deal with actively, but it's something that I think I would, I mean, I would never align with medication. I think that kind of goes against what I believe in.
But what? We lost Sam again. But, Sam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry. We're having problems with our phone lines here. I apologize for that. So what is it you're struggling with now that you can't get out of?
Well, I don't feel I'm justified to be depressed. I mean, I think I have a kind of a good stand on life as it is. I don't have student debt, and, like, I have a good job, and I guess I have a good kind of base of friends, but I guess it's something that's from my history that I really can't seem to, like, fully understand and wrap my head around, even with going to therapy. So I guess it is something that I believe is, like, just beyond medication, something that could be, like, neurological or whatnot.
You know, one of the things I wonder, Sam, and I'll want to hear your take on this, John, is I wonder how much of what you deal with is about trauma and some form of PTSD. And I think back over my depression and the original one, the severe one, and I think that was, in hindsight, PTSD. And just recently, I had a trauma on the road a few months ago that just opened up all of the my stuff from the original trauma, and I felt a depression creeping back in. Fortunately, it hasn't overwhelmed me, but it had been creeping back in. So how much of depression is in so many cases is about trauma. John, I'd like to hear your case, your take on this.
I agree 100%, and that the trauma associated with suicide is very great indeed. And to lose somebody in those circumstances inflicts a deep wound. And trauma is an important contributor, and it's really important that doctors and psychiatrists ask about trauma, because often because of the shame associated with it, it's hidden. And Sam was talking about that he didn't feel entitled to feel depressed, and that speaks to me a little bit of,
shame.
Not allowing oneself to experience some of these feelings, which kind of may be beyond one's control.
Yeah. Sam, do we still have you?
Yes.
Yeah, so tell me about what you do experience, whether you're entitled to or not. Tell me what it is like to be you.
Well, I guess because I am a very sociable person. I'm generally a very happy person. And when you'd ask my peers, my coworkers, whatnot, if I am depressed, they would probably say no. They wouldn't know that about me.
And what would Sam say about him?
Oh, that I am very much so. And that's something that I deal with very much on a personal level. Now, I'm not someone who bottles this up at all. I'm talking on the radio right now. But because I talk to my peers, I compare myself a lot to others. One of your previous talkers was talking about Facebook, and I do spend a lot of time looking at these other people's lives and just saying, like, why wasn't mine so grand? In my own mind, it's kind of a duality. Like, in my mind, I can see these problems, but then I see perfection and something that I would never change.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go back and change anything that I've experienced, because it's making me such a better person for it. But it's just beyond that, it's like something that's so debilitating, and I can't
enjoy
my spare time, because it's just like, yeah, it's holding me back.
You know what, Sam? All buried emotions are buried alive, and there's something in there that won't let go of you. And, you know, something in there is demanding attention, and it's like physical pain. You know, it demands attention. Johnny, let's hear what you have to say about this. And Sam, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Well, I think it speaks to the importance of therapy, too, to treat depression with medication alone in all circumstances is pretty dumb, actually. And you need to get at what have been the important factors that have let loose the depression. And it's not either medications or brain devices or therapy that's a false reductionism. It's the best of all three, as indicated for the individual patient. And Sam has done a terrific job of managing this despite its difficulties. And he's to be commended.
So in the couple seconds we have left, do you envision one day when magnets will be the first choice for depression and medication will be the last?
I don't think so. I think the magnets tend to be time-consuming, so they won't be first-line.
Yeah.
Maybe you have two first-line treatments, both therapy and medications together.
It is always best to have many, many options. John O'Riordan, I want to thank you so much for joining our discussion today and for what you do. You're doing some important work. So thanks
thank
so
much
for joining us. Thanks. Well, we're at the end of our hour, and I want to thank John O'Riordan, professor of psychiatry at Rowan. And earlier we heard from Dr. Michael Yapko, clinical psychologist, and Dr. Jonathan Rottenberg, associate professor of psychology at the University of Florida. Well, you can follow us on Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam, and email us, voices@whyy.org. And I'm on drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer has been Bob Alls. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern, and she has become beloved by so many at the station, so many of us at Voices, and beloved by me personally. Your last day, I love you, Lindsay. Thank you. Larry Roebling produces our show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.